CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. Also, National Association of Corporate Directors, an association created for directors by directors whose mission is to advance exemplary board leadership. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And in today's CFO news, CFO radio news published by CFO.com, we are talking about an article looking at the global outlook being mixed. It is headed with a title, Proceeding with Caution. While the global outlook is mixed, U.S. CFOs are somewhat more optimistic, and the article is written by Kate Sullivan. Even as the global economy continues to be volatile, U.S. CFOs are slightly more optimistic than they were 3 months ago. The latest Duke University and CFO magazine Global Business Outlook survey finds that the CFO optimism index has moved up to the 53 on a scale of 1 to 100 from 47 last quarter. However, that level is still below the survey's long-term average of 60. Finance chiefs plan to increase hiring this year but are still cautious, putting the chance of the United States entering a new recession in the next 6 months at 31%. These mixed signals reflect the very mixed results across the individual businesses. For example, on one hand, says Mark Muscovich, finance chief at Wisconsin-based JX Enterprises, a heavy-duty truck dealer, our little corner of the economy is doing very well, thanks in part to customers' increasing need for parts and service as they keep old vehicles on the road. On the other hand, Milton Bullock, CFO at Alpha Steel, a steel fabrication company in Texas that has seen its business fall by half over the past few years, reports, the economy for the year ahead is brutal, citing a lack of demand for the company's products, mainly used in building schools, strip malls, and multi-story office buildings. The business has shifted to focus on federal government contracting in recent years with good results. That's what's kept us going, says Bullock. Rob Ogilby, CFO at Wish Farms in Florida, says his business is relatively insulated from the economy, as demand for the company's produce typically outstrips supply. As for the broader economy, he says, I think we're basically going to have a repeat of 2011. It's a perception issue. We may see growth in some sectors, but the typical American sees a bad economy, and that's what they're reacting to. At Measurement, Inc., an educational testing company in Florida, CFO Alex Avila echoes Ogilby's view on the year ahead. With his business dependent on state and federal education standards and budgets, Avila says, everybody's kind of in waiting mode. On average, CFOs do plan to boost expenditures in key categories, such as capital spending, which they say will increase by 8% over the next 12 months, a marked increase from their plans last quarter, when they said that capital expenditure would rise by just 4.5%. Technology spending will grow by 6%, also an increase from last quarter, while research and development spending will increase by just under 3%, and marketing advertising spending will grow by about 2%, both in line with the levels forecast 3 months ago. Now, on the critical jobs front, finance executives have a somewhat improved outlook, which is good news for those in the finance function looking in transition right now. The outlook has somewhat improved compared with the last quarter, and the CFOs are now saying they plan to increase their full-time domestic workforces by 1.5% on average over the next year, up from just 1% last quarter. Such an increase would yield enough jobs to bring unemployment rate to near 8% by the end of the year, says the article. Well, CFOs are also worried about global financial instability, the article says in its wrap-up, with nearly a quarter saying their businesses would experience a significant effect should multiple European banks become insolvent, and an additional 59% saying they would feel a minor impact. Well, that's our CFO Radio News for today. We are going to talk about a little bit of a different type of a program today. We're going to talk about system implementations and the top reasons they fail and the lessons that we can learn from those failures. And we're going to use as the basis for this discussion and presentation two articles. One article is found at www.harvard.edu. Thanks go to Harvard University for allowing us to present this. And then also an article by Lorraine Chilvers, CFO radio host from Teesside University. The report from Harvard that we've discussed here is called Top 10 Reasons Why System Projects Fail. And the author is Dr. Paul Dorsey of Dulcian Inc. Dr. Paul Dorsey is the founder and president of Dulcian Inc., an Oracle consulting firm that specializes in data warehousing, web and client server systems development, and products that support the Oracle environment. Paul is co-author with Peter Koletsky of Oracle Press, Oracle Designer Handbook, Oracle Developer Forms and Reports, the Advanced Techniques and Development Standards, and with Joseph Hudica of Oracle Press's Oracle 8 Design using UML Object Modeling. Paul is an associate editor of Select Magazine and is president of the New York Oracle Users Group. And the article used by myself, Lorraine Chilvers, is called An Investigation of Internal Control Requirements and Information Flow of the Computer-Based Data Processing System at XYZ Limited. Lorraine Chilvers is a senior finance executive with progressive leadership roles, having served in executive roles within the worldwide functions of two Fortune 500 companies and serving as a partner with the largest executive services firm in the United States. My experience includes Big Six public accounting, business transformation, SEC reporting, SOX compliance within telecom, manufacturing, supply chain management, and technology. Lorraine has led the finance functions for companies and also achieved success leading technology, capital, human capital programs, sales and marketing, legal and operations functions. As steering committee leader and project manager, Lorraine has managed technology implementations for SAP, Oracle, Hyperion, JD Edwards, and PeopleSoft Technology Solutions. Lorraine Chilvers is host of CFO Radio, an internationally renowned radio show that is listened to on three continents across the world. Well, here we are. We have the article from Dr. Paul Dorsey. We're going to take a brief look at that in terms of his top 10 reasons why system projects fail. And as an overview, Paul had talked in his program and his article that information systems projects frequently fail. And it's a little disconcerting to those of you that may be listening on his use of the term frequently fail. And he says, depending on which academic study you read, the failure rate of large projects is reported as being between 50 to 80%. Because of the natural human tendency to hide bad news, the real statistic may be even higher. And he says this is catastrophic. As an industry, we are failing at our jobs. Based on past experience, when undertaking a large, complex systems project, the realistic expectation should be that the project will fail. In particular, business process re-engineering, which he uses the acronym BPR, projects have an even higher failure rate because of their expanded scope. Hiring a large, established consulting company, he states, is no guarantee of success. Neither is buying packaged software and implementing it. Projects are frequently built using strategy that almost guarantees failure, he goes on to say. Software engineering is a kind of engineering. Building a large information system is like constructing a 20-story office building. If a bunch of electricians, plumbers, carpenters, and contractors meet in a field, talk for a few hours, and then start building, the building will be unstable if it even gets to be built at all. At one of the presentations, an audience member shared the quip that if building engineers built buildings with the same care as software engineers build systems, the first woodpecker to come along would be the end of civilization as we know it. If we would keep in mind that building software is just like building an office building, then most of our problems would go away. Before building an office building, an architect draws up detailed plans, builds models, makes blueprints. At each stage, the plans are carefully and repeatedly reviewed. During construction, each step is tested and inspected. In software projects, if we haven't started writing code in 3 months, we mistakenly think that something must be wrong. Can't we see the senselessness of plunging ahead without a careful plan? As an example, on one project I was involved with, the project manager brought in the tech writing team to start writing the training manuals before the user interface was even stable. This is about as smart as bringing in the painters before the walls have been built, says Paul. So really, what causes the system projects to fail? Is it some technical secret that most system engineers don't know? Are software projects so drastically complex that only the most talented teams have a hope of succeeding? Paul says that he has personally been involved in both successful projects and projects that crashed and burned. The sad fact is that software projects fail because we do not recognize good engineering principles should be applied to the software projects just as they are to building office buildings. We try to defend ourselves by saying that the software construction is different. When Peter Kolensky and Paul published the Designer/2000 Handbook, we sneaked in quite a lot of material on software engineering. We tried to write about how one should best build a system using the Designer product. The way that this material was received by the community is interesting and still sometimes negative. One reader quipped, "I already know how to build systems. All I need to know is what to click on in the tool." Another complained that there were no insights in the book and that it was just a rehash of the SDLC junk that they made me read in school. More experienced system engineers have been involved in numerous projects saw the value of the book and were quite receptive. But I think the most interesting comment on the book came from my brother Walt, says Paul. Walt is a real engineer who's managed the quality function for several large technical manufacturers. He told me that he liked the book and that the advice in the book largely mirrored the way that large projects are managed in the companies he worked in. He was surprised that this kind of development method was not normal as a part of the normal way that systems are built today. Paul goes on to say that he's given many presentations at Oracle conferences, and he says, "If I talk about how to improve database design, I can usually attract 30 to 50 listeners. If I talk about improving the Java development environment, I can usually get between 300 and 500 listeners. I believe that this lack of interest in methodology is at heart the problem, the source of our problems. Many of us mistakenly believe that the only real contribution to a project is writing the code. Using the office building example again, that's like saying if you don't have a hammer or a paintbrush in your hand, your contribution to the building is not significant." Don't expect to read any brilliant insights in this paper, Paul goes on to say. I will share with you my successes, failures, and my near catastrophes. My ultimate conclusion is that the best way to make a project succeed is to use your head. How can we avoid making the mistakes that lead projects to failure? Surprisingly, the answer is most simple and common sense. Our project is that common sense is often ignored in system projects. So let's talk a little bit more about what Paul goes on to say. And he says there are three keys to a project success. These are, in a systems project, he refers to them as a tripod, and the three legs of critical success factors consist of the following. 1, top management support. 2, a sound methodology. And 3, solid technical leadership by somebody who has successfully completed a similar project. And he goes on to say, without each of these solidly in place, the tripod will topple and the project will fail. Well, let's look at the article from Lorraine Chilvers from Teesside University. She did a study on a specific company in the United Kingdom that was a small company looking to implement software at the beginning phases of their software technology implementation. And the conclusions that she drew are that the managing director was in control of the direct employees of the company and the procedures that were carried out. And the fact that the company was small brought some very significant intrigue into the system implementation. And the system implementation took about 4 months. There was a business re-engineering process that took 3 months, 4 months prior to that, and conducted a review of the company, which was a logistics and supply chain management firm that also had national and international operations. And the company's main aim when this system was implemented was very much more of a financial and analytical aim to the project. The company's aim was to reduce its current overdraft and looking at cash flow procedures. They really wanted to look at profitability from a cash flow perspective, and they didn't have the tools with which to look at that level of data in that way. They wanted to look at the company's less profitable areas of storage and distribution and to make them become more profitable. The managing director, who would in the United States have the CEO role, the managing director was concerned about the overdraft that was becoming much more significant on a daily basis. He was also concerned about the company's ability to gain new customers. And then thirdly, he had a concern regarding the company's ability to be dynamic and react to changes in rates that they charged for the services, which would ultimately lead to a higher profit margin to be made. Now, unfortunately, one of the main weaknesses of the control system that was in place at that company was that the managing director had significant control, and with the company being relatively small, he felt that he could not delegate all of the work that he needed to. And one of the fears was that when the system was implemented, he needed to make sure that that delegation took place at the lower levels of employees so that the control and the financial analytics would be done by his staff. And he's asked advice on many matters which other employees of the company should be able to deal with. And that was something that was a concern for him, particularly when he was dealing with investors. And he wanted to be able to get results that had been analyzed at a greater level of detail, and the system was going to be able to do that. And part of what was the benefit of the system was going to be more detailed level of drill downs, more detailed level of analytical review. And so we have today a comparison of very significant, the Harvard Business School program of implementation, which is describing large ERP systems, and then that of a very small company overseas. So let's go down and drill into some of those three key project areas that Paul details in his report. Top management support, this is the first key area that he described. And Paul says, every study ever done about system success or failure has identified top management support as a critical success factor. Without full commitment from top management, when problems arise on a project, as they inevitably do, the project will collapse. The management personnel in any organization that undertakes a systems project should be aware up front that the project will encounter some serious setbacks. And I too have found this in the multiple system implementations that I've done. And I would say that this is across the board, somewhat irrelevant of whether you're implementing SAP, Oracle, JD Edwards, Hyperion, the former PeopleSoft, or any of the new versions of products, that I would go down to including Dynamics, Great Plains, even all the way down to a QuickBooks or Quicken. You still need to have controls in place. And in fact, more so when you get to smaller companies. So Paul goes on to say he was involved in one system where the implementation was going poorly. Rank and file users were about to revolt. However, top management stayed behind the project and it did eventually succeed. And he goes on to say that if the management had not been committed, the project, he believes, would surely have failed. In another working system, the project was going fine, but a new manager came in and the project just disappeared overnight. In fact, a few of the failed projects that Paul has been involved in were cancelled by a person whom no one on the development team had even met. This leads to a more important point that a project will not be successful if management doesn't think that it is successful. So management needs to be educated about the process, needs to be educated about the system implementation, receiving very frequent updates, and to be involved. And in this regard, the steering committee, which is a representation of the management, I have found myself, is very crucial, because if you don't have that support from the top tier, things will fail. When it comes time to asking for more monies, or for capital spend being done on the labor as well as the capital components of the project, and or the consultants that are being used if you use some from the outside, management all of a sudden looks at the dollars and is trying to determine ROI. And it's critical from my perspective that you do include ROI calculations so that you can make sure that management is fully informed so that they can make those decisions. Well, Paul goes on to say there is a real difference between systems, projects, and office buildings, and he continues to use this parallel. When a building is half done, there is something to see. However, he goes on to say, when a software project is half done, there is very little, if anything, to see. Management need to know what they can expect to see and when. If they assume that the project will have 50% of the systems running when the budget is 50% spent, they will probably start thinking about pulling the plug on a project that is progressing exactly on schedule. He goes on to say, beware of the skilled developer who thinks he or she is a project lead. An experienced developer with several years' experience may not understand the design of the system. However, they can single-handedly kill a project with a well-placed opinion. Paul continues to say managers often do not themselves understand the design of a system. They rely on the opinions of skilled advisors. The key to managing the managers is to bring in high-level objective auditors. In a consulting environment, that is particularly important. How can management know that they are not being cheated or that the project is not being mismanaged? They don't have the skills to assess the situation. A project can be ended by management simply because they misunderstand the actions of the development team. In such cases, Paul says, having a technical audit can validate the actions of the development team and project management with the information required to continue supporting the project. Well, at this point, I'd like to talk about the second area the Harvard review, and this is talking about a sound methodology. And this is something where we go on to looking at methodology. It's very key, and Paul puts in his article that you have systems that are being built with thought to the process, and that means the development methodology. Paul says, a team gets together and starts performing the activities. As soon as enough information is gathered, coding begins. This lack of attention to process can kill a system. It's easy to see the result of a lack of attention to process after a system fails. Usually, major portions of the user requirements are ignored. Large amounts of code need to be rewritten. Since it does not meet user requirements the first time around, if completed, the system is put into place with inadequate testing. Without a well-thought-out process, there's little chance that a systems project will be completed. And if the project does succeed, it only does so with substantial rewrites and cost overruns. And something that Paul is highlighting in this article is very much a key to a component of system implementations that we often come to, and that is one of cost, the time frame of the spend the time flow of the time flow of the cash being written, i.e. the checks going out of the door. And Paul goes on to say, it may be surprising to think that the methodology selected in his view doesn't matter. But in fact, this is basically true. What does matter is that there is some methodology. There is no explicit research to indicate that any one particular methodology is any better than any other. What Paul says is important is keeping the project organized in a consistent fashion and a focused way, and thinking through the process carefully at the outset. He goes on to say, different methodologies all gather the same information but organize it differently. And I found this too on my various different projects, whether I've been on the steering committee or project manager or in my earlier days doing the program and process reengineering. Different consulting firms, if you use them, will have different methodologies. Some use a project management approach that brings in their own personalized tools, and some use those that have been developed by the software manufacturer themselves. And they all have a system of timekeeping, tracking, record keeping, status updates, and so forth. Now, what Paul goes on to say is that the different approaches to systems development, object-oriented, rapid prototyping, and waterfall, etc., they use different tools to accomplish the same tasks. An object-oriented approach would employ use cases in analysis, whereas a traditional Oracle professional will use a function hierarchy. If a particular organization has talent in one specific area, there's no reason not to exploit that expertise, says Paul. For example, if you have a number of object-oriented developers, an object-oriented approach would be a clear choice. Similarly, a shop with an Oracle designer expertise may use the CADM methodology. As I've stated elsewhere, it can be useful if the methodology selected is tightly integrated with the development tools selected, and there will be less wasted effort. Well, Paul highlights something that I believe is critical here, that of the development methodology. And what he's talking about is really a very key component to making sure that the project is done correctly. Now, the third area in Paul's article is technical leadership. And he says in his article, just as a building needs an architect, a software system needs a technical lead. And to be successful, the architect or the technical lead must be the one in control of the architecture of the project, namely the data model and the application design, which is the language that we use in a system overview. This level of control must be recognized and acknowledged by everyone involved in the project. Otherwise, each portion of the system may be constructed independently by a portion of the team, and the pieces won't fit together at the end. Paul goes on to say, the technical lead must have built similar systems down to the level of the specific business area for which the system is being built. And I found that that is very crucial. Paul says, for example, any system that includes financial functions must usually interface with existing accounting functionality. He goes on to talk about interdependent factors in project success. And these are four independent factors that he refers to. And this interdependency is very key. These are 1, cost, 2, quality, 3, speed, and 4, risk. It's not possible to have the best of all factors. Specifically, you cannot have a system built inexpensively, of high quality, built quickly, and with little or no risk of failure. Most discussions of these factors only include the first 3, and those, as a reminder, are cost, quality, and speed. It is possible to build a high-quality system quickly at a relatively low cost by cutting corners and doing little or no testing. However, this is where you get into the risk area, in my opinion, when you reduce the cost, when you reduce the quality, and you increase your speed. From my experience, what you're doing is you're increasing the risk of the project, and you're increasing the possibility or probability of failure of that engagement. Paul goes on to say, however, the risk of such a system failing increases dramatically. Of the four factors in any project, two are always possible to achieving success, and he argues that this leaves the other two to be managed. Of the four factors, the most two important are risk and quality. The system must work and successfully meet user requirements. This leaves speed or time and cost or money to be adjusted accordingly. And my experience has shown that you will actually find this during a system implementation. You will have a budget at the beginning. You'll have an estimate of how much time that it'll take. Very often you may need to bring in additional people, additional resources. You may find that you need to bring these in for purposes of technical expertise, but you also may find that you need it just to stay on track and keep the project on track. Particularly in my experience, if you're using personnel that have a day-to-day shared function within the corporate environment or the business environment in operations, what you'll find is that the day-to-day activities will strip and take focus and priority over the system implementation. And that's something that I have experienced and causes a very significant issue on the project, because now you have other project team members waiting for that one person to re-engage. And then the cost and the money aspect of it. Very often systems take a little bit longer than anticipated. System implementations take longer than expected. And that time equates to money. People on the project, whether it's internal cost of time and labor being transferred from one department to the project, or whether it means outside advisors, consultants, and people that you've brought in. If you delay the project, sometimes the software costs may increase, and you should make sure to include that in your budget and also in your agreement with the software vendor. Paul goes on to say, if you insist on fast developments, time or low cost, then quality and risk will shift accordingly. Paul says he has had many arguments with managers over this principle. He says he's been told, if we use product X and methodology Y, we can have the system built quickly at minimal cost. This is not a realistic or a tenable position, Paul says. You can insist on low risk and high quality, recognizing that time and money may be adjusted. In fact, his article says must be adjusted to achieve these goals. Now, Paul goes on to talk about data migration and implementation and the factors determined in the success of the project, often forgotten are data migration and the system implementation itself. And I found this in my experiences, particularly in the article that I wrote that we referred to from the company in the UK. This was a client company for me, and the data migration was something that they estimated too little time on in order to perform the work. And it did impact the system implementation. Paul says in his article, data migration should be as planned for early on in any project. Data migration should almost be considered as a separate project in its own right. Similarly, even a well-crafted, well-documented, and carefully designed system can fail, argues Paul, by 10 to 20% of the time because the implementation is not handled correctly. So Paul goes on to list the top 10 ways to guarantee the failure of a systems project. And I find this rather interesting that he talks about guaranteeing failure of a systems project, unique way to look at the world. And we're going to spend a little bit of time on this, but the CFO Radio podcast has attached a link so that you can actually go and look at the full detail of this. So the top 10 ways to guarantee the failure of a systems project in Paul's article. Number one, don't use a specific methodology because coding is all that's really important. Two, create the project plan by working backwards from a drop-dead system completion date. And he talks that working backwards from fixed project completion date is a sure way to guarantee project failure. And yet, unfortunately, this is all too common a practice in the IT community. And I myself have seen that. We need to implement by X date. Sometimes in a publicly held company, it might be a Sarbanes-Oxley requirement to keep out of that final fourth quarter so that audit and Sarbanes-Oxley testing can be performed. In smaller privately held companies, it may be just wanting to keep away from a particular time, high seasonality of sales, or the year-end or the audit work. Paul says, failure to perform careful analysis results in critical new requirements being uncovered late in the development process. Failure to take data migration into account can have an impact. Failure to accurately assess the political climate of the organization vis-a-vis the project. And then failure to enlist approval at all levels of the user community. That is an area where I have found in my experience of implementations that you can trip up. If you don't have the full business operations personnel involved in the project at the very earliest stages of the system implementation, you can get down to the level of testing. And I've even been brought in at one stage of a project system implementation at that stage where they needed almost a mediator was my role. And the level of the system implementation, the testing had begun and certain business units had not been included. And they said, what are we doing? What are you doing? No, you can't change my system. And it took the project a very long step. And in fact, if I recall correctly, it was about a 6 to 8 week time lapse and halt to the project in order to bring those users of the end system back on board. So Paul goes to say item number 3, failure. Don't bother with a data model. Just build whatever tables you need. Well, this is something where clearly you don't try and build a building without knowing what your construction materials are going to be. So I think that that's something very, very critical. Paul says, number 4, use a technical lead that has never built a similar system. This is hiring such talent is too expensive. And Paul is focusing here, I believe, on an area that is very critical. If you don't have the right technical lead in place, your project will fail. If that technical lead does not have the experience previously, the project is likely to fail. And very often a technical lead may be brought from within the company, maybe somebody that has a business knowledge, but it is critically important that that person has system implementation experience, multiple system implementation experience. Number 5, Paul says, hire 40 developers to make the coding go faster. And here Paul says, more is not always better. This is especially true in the case of development teams. A project manager with a few very skilled developers, carefully supervised by the appropriate technical lead, has a much greater chance of success than one where hordes of developers are cranking out mountains of code each day. And the problem that I see in the example that Paul has given, and it really is a critical factor for success or failure, is that you then have almost too many cooks in the kitchen. You then need to bring in all of the components of that data development and each of the skilled developers, and you need to essentially bridge the gap from one developer to the other, and it just simply is harder. 6, Paul says, build the system in Java, even though the most of the development team still thinks that Java is a coffee and you have no intention of ever deploying to the web. Well, Paul, I'm going to use one of his quotes. The right tool for the job is what he said. This motto is as true for building systems as it is for building houses. One of the problems, Paul says, for many system architects is the fact that the availability of tools greatly influence the way the systems are built. Even the basics of the development process are influenced by the tools selected. His recommendation is to make sure that all the necessary expertise is in place for whatever development tool is selected. And going on to number 7 of his top 10 failures, 3 months before the system goes live, assign one junior developer to handle the data migration. Well, again, we've talked about the leadership of the project implementation And Paul says the data migration phase of a project can consume up to 30% of the total project resources. So, and moving on, skip number 8, skip the testing phase before the project is way behind. And clearly you cannot skip the testing phase, but time and time again, my experience has shown when time is tight that organizations do look to skipping phases of the testing. I've never seen anyone totally skip testing in its entirety, but there may be level 1 testing, level 2 testing. There may be various different elements of you tend not to do a full parallel testing, but various elements of that functional testing can be skipped. Number 9, Paul says, change the system to support critical new requirements discovered during the final development stage. And this is what we refer to as scope creep on a project. There will always be new requirements to support. There will always be better ways to perform functions in your business. And you need to make sure that you keep on track and that these new requirements will be built into a later phase. And what I have found is that in terms of when these new items come up, new requirements come up, that you have an agreed upon process ahead of the project implementation, that when these come up, that they will be archived, that there will be a risk assessment in terms of total failure to the project if these do not go through. And in the rare instances where I have found that this new requirement came in and it was absolutely critical, it was essentially something that was overlooked or missed in the earlier stages. But anything that truly is a new requirement, it needs to be archived, it needs to be put into a later phase of project reengineering and system implementation. And then 10, and finally, Paul says the critical success requirement, should I say, the critical failure requirement, buy a commercial off-the-shelf package and customize it a lot. The only way, Paul says, for a commercial off-the-shelf package implementation to be successful is to decide at the outset that you're going to re-engineer your business to fit the limitations of the commercial off-the-shelf package. And these packages usually include and imply a specific method of doing business with a corresponding set of capabilities. And you see that so much, particularly in the large-scale implementations, the larger software manufacturers actually come with a methodology, and they very much suggest that you do not customize the software, but that you may do configuration from a user perspective, but keep customization to a minimal or none whatsoever. So in conclusion, Dr. Paul Dorsey in his report says, in order to ensure system success, there are several factors to keep in mind. 1, don't cut corners, methodology. In the long run, this results in systems failure or an inadequate system. Number 2, audit each major deliverable and step along the way for accuracy and correctness. Number 3, carefully monitor top management support for the project and make sure that managers are all aware of the progress of the team. And finally, 4, secure the correct technical lead for the project. There's no free lunch in software engineering. If you insist on keeping costs low and hurrying the project along, then quality will be low or the risk of failure will be high, no matter how well the project is managed. And just to add my flavor from the experiences that I have had, is that when you are said and done on all this and time and pressure is tight on a project, very often it is the last couple of phases of the project implementation that get cut short. When time is pressured and when costs are getting near to or maybe overrunning that original estimate, very often preparation of all the user reports that are needed and configuration of the system, corners may be cut. Very often the training and the time and the cost to train personnel may be cut. Very often the program to create a user-driven manual, the time may be cut and the monies associated with that may be cut. And all of these components are very, very critical to the end user creating reports, using the systems daily. Those that are going to use the system need to be trained. They need to have the tools to be able to write and read and run the system once implemented. And then my final comment would be, in addition to what Dr. Paul Dorsey has said, is that don't get rid of your project management or project implementation team too soon. Make sure that you have engaged resources for after the go live date. You want people to be around for your first month end, your first quarter end, if it's a financial system implementation that you're doing, and or if it's something where it is maybe less focused on the key financial aspects. It may be a sales customer order entry system implementation. Make sure that you do the timing such that you go through various different progressions of after the fact implementation and after go live. Make sure that you're very happy that you have people to help you after the fact. And this brings us to a conclusion in terms of CFO Radio. It has been a pleasure to bring you a different and a unique component of what is our usual guest approach. And this is Lorraine Chilvers saying thank you very much for listening to us today. If you would like to be a guest on CFO Radio, please contact us via the web. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing interim and project management consulting and permanent placement to Fortune 1000 companies and small business growing alike. And thanks also go to National Association of Corporate Directors for the work that they do. Thanks to listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers. Until next time.